Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today's date is March 1st, 2007. Scheduled meeting time for 3 o'clock p.m. in Hearing Room B. Senator Brad Avakian is chair.
Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources is open. Today we have got ballast water and then the opening of the Oregon Renewable Energy Act on our agenda, and we're going to start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 643 and Senate Bill 644. Everybody signed up on both sign-up sheets, which is great, but of course you know, go ahead and testify on both. And welcome to the committee, Representative Jensen and Boone. Oh, and Sue Marshall is going to give us a quick summary of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 643 creates a Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force, revises the definition of cargo vessel, sets a sunset to be the convening date of the next regular biennial legislative session. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and for the record, we received a letter from the Native Fish Society in support of the measure.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify and urge you to pass out these two very important bills. I've been dealing with this issue now for, I think, 8 years in the Oregon legislature, and quite frankly, I don't know of a more vulnerable part of our economy in the state than the topic that you're dealing with, the invasive species coming into the country. I shudder at the possibility of some type of eco-terrorism, from this. Things could happen that would be devastating to the economy of the state of Oregon. We've been very, very fortunate to have been having Portland State, working on this and keeping us moving forward with it. And I commend you for the work you're doing with it and encourage you to proceed with all due haste as you've indicated you are.
Well, and I know you need to run back to your other committee, but I just wanted to say to you that this committee is very grateful for the leadership you have shown on this issue over the years, and especially in this session when we will actually get the bill moving.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you again for the opportunity to come here, and it's always good to see the folks from the hallowed chamber of the building.
He knows how to get a bill out of committee, doesn't he? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jensen and I were going to ride in on a quarter horse together just to make a point, but it didn't seem to fit with a ship ballast bill, so we didn't. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I, too, I bring you greetings and support from our entire Coastal Caucus, which is 8 members plus 1 from the inland, so it's 9 members now, both House and Senate, the coastal people, and 1 inside down by the Klamath, Senator Whitsitt. And we support this wholeheartedly. I prepared 6 pages of testimony, but I won't read it into the record because you look a little tired. So anyway, I just wanted to let you know the Coastal Caucus will take stands on a bill occasionally as it pertains to our interest area, and this does very much so. And I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to go into all the scientific pieces. You'll hear that too. But we felt strongly enough about this to bring our support, and I would have personally supported it in any case. So thank you for what you're doing, and I expect to see it coming out at the end of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Brad Witt is here, too. He's graciously allowed a couple other folks to go ahead. We appreciate that. So next will be Dr. Mark Sitzma and Sue Allen.
Good afternoon, Chair Avakian and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Allen, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 643 and 644. I bring to these concepts 2 things, an institutional memory of the legislation and a great respect for the diversity of native species that Oregon's shores host. Prior to my legislative career, I worked in the field with a degree from OSU in zoology, and I have personally seen the quick work that non-native species can do to our native waterways. After working in the biological sciences, I started working on Oregon's first ballast water regulation, which included the creation of the ballast water task force in the 2001 legislative session. I worked with Representative Jensen, Senator Messerly, and Representative Deborah Kefauver as Representative Kefauver's legislative aide. Subsequent legislation was passed in 2003 and 2005, which brought housekeeping pieces and substance, but no staff time devoted to actual enforcement. Senate Bill 643 and 644 represent a small but significant step in implementing the Ballast Water Task Force's recommendations that begin to align Oregon with Washington and California on ballast water regulation and protection of our native waterways. After 6 years of volunteer work, the Ballast Water Task Force has brought stakeholders together, including the ports, the shipping industry, and the scientific community. I applaud the work of my colleague, Dr. Sisma, who will speak to the technical aspects of the bill. Dr. Sisma is an associate professor in environmental science at Portland State University. In 2004, he completed the first comprehensive study of the Lower Columbia River for aquatic invasive species and is currently expanding that work to the middle reaches of the Columbia. In 2001, he wrote the Oregon Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan that was approved by the governor and the National Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force, and which he is currently implementing at PSU. He chaired the Oregon Ballast Water Task Force from 2001 to 2006 and is a founding member and past chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. I want to thank the committee for your consideration, and I urge your support of passage 643 and 644.
Thank you, Ms. Allen. Doctor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Sitzma. I'm an associate professor of environmental science at Portland State University, and last interim I chaired the Oregon Ballast Water Task Force. We all recognize that shipping is critical to the economy of Oregon, and ballast water is critical to shipping. It's needed for ships to actually function. The problem is that ballast water taken up in port in a foreign port takes up foreign organisms as well, and that those organisms can be deposited in Oregon waters when that ship discharges ballast water. Oregon is particularly at risk for ballast water invasions because of the unique character of the shipping industry in the Columbia River. Exporting bulk cargo is the main business of Oregon ports. If you see from your from my testimony that I handed out on the first page, shows the percent of arrivals and percent of ballast water discharge for various ship types. And you can see bulk carriers discharge by far the majority of ballast water. Since bulkers are slow moving, carry large volumes of water, they can be particularly problematic when for introduced species. One of the consequences of, page two, you can see a comparison of the Columbia River ballast water discharge with Puget Sound, San Francisco, and L.A. Long Beach. And surprisingly, Columbia River receives more ballast water from either of these other West Coast ports, despite the fact that L.A. Long Beach, of course, is a huge port, much larger than the Columbia River. Again, this is a function of the type of shipping. We get mostly bulkers that carry large volumes of ballast water and discharge those large volumes. L.A. Long Beach gets primarily container ships that don't require as much ballast water. So as a consequence, we're particularly at risk. And one of the consequences of that is some of the results we found from our survey of the Lower Columbia River, as Susan mentioned, in 2004. Currently, the zooplankton community in the Columbia River is dominated by Asian species. We really don't know the consequences of that for the ecosystem in the long term, but those sorts of subtle changes in the base of the food web can have pretty severe consequences for the rest of the ecosystem. You can see on page 3 a figure from our survey that shows the rate of accumulation of introduced invertebrate species and introduced fish in the Columbia River. You can see in recent years there's been a huge increase in invertebrate introductions to the Columbia River, and at the same time kind of a leveling off of fish introductions. So you can see there's a slight shift in activities in the river. A lot of those early fish introductions were for sport fishing, so that was curtailed. But the rate of introduction of invertebrates, and these are primarily small little zooplankton that can't possibly swim all the way from Japan, for example, across the ocean to the Columbia River. So the most likely way they were introduced to the river is through ballast water. Ballast water, of course, isn't the only pathway of introduction of invasive species. There's a invertebrate just recently introduced into Lake Mead called the quagga mussel, which is a relative to the zebra mussel. That's a major concern because it's a huge jump in the range of that invasive species from the Great Lakes to the western U.S. So there are other activities in the state that we address through the State Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan that try and address those sorts of pathways, but the point I'm trying to make is that there are other pathways besides shipping for invasive species that we need to be concerned about. So in 2005, the legislature created the Ballast Water Task Force and charged us with reporting on a number of items. I won't read them. They're on page 3 and 4. That's what the committee, the legislature asked us to address. We submitted a report, which hopefully you've seen before, in October, that summarizes our recommendations. Members of the task force, again, are on page 4, and I won't read them, but I guess I would just summarize by saying we had a broad representation from fish and wildlife agencies, our neighboring states, ports, steamship operators, environmental groups, and Senator Johnson and Representative Krieger were the legislative representatives on the Ballast Water Task Force. So in summary, the task force recommendations included in the report, there were four major ones. One was to support and encourage development of federal ballast water treatment standards that are protective of Oregon's water resources. Federal agencies, the Coast Guard, has been a little slow in developing these standards for discharge, and that sort of limits the capability of industry to begin to address develop treatment technology that can treat the ballast water and eliminate the organisms from the discharge. They really need a target for the discharge so they can start developing the technologies. The recommendation was to give the Coast Guard and the feds a few more years, and if they don't do it, we should start thinking about doing something on our own, like our neighboring states are doing. The Columbia River, of course, is shared waters. One of the recommendations of the task force was to establish a Columbia River Commission on Bioinvasions with representatives from both states. Subsequent to writing the report, we've talked to the people in Washington, and there's not much interest in another commission, but there is interest in better collaboration and cooperation on some existing committees that I think we can use to sort of address this coordination issue on the river. Really, the meat of the recommendation was really a small piece of meat, actually, in this recommendation. That's to change the definition of cargo vessel in the law, and that's in the bill, and that's probably one of the most important aspects. It's a small change. It takes out the word self-propelled and inserts language that says if a ship has ballast water tanks, it must report its ballast water management. That was recommended because barges are technically not self-propelled, but they should still report because they have ballast water tanks. So this change is really, it makes it explicit that we need barges to report, and also brings us into, makes our definition similar to the federal Coast Guard definition of ships and what the types of ships should be reporting. Also recommended creating a shipping transport of aquatic invasive species task force, basically recreate the task force that has existed in the past three interims, to just update the legislature again next session on changes in the law, federal law, neighboring states, and to make some recommendations on some other potential important pathways of introduction of invasive species, such as whole fouling. Lastly, the recommendation included a recommendation of the task force was to fund a position at DEQ to run the program. That's in Senate Bill 644 does that. In the past, the PSU has supported DEQ enforcement of this program through grants and contracts, and that's difficult to keep going. Most agencies don't like to fund ongoing programs. And lastly, with the recommendations of the task force, I appreciate your attention to this issue and happy to answer any questions you might have.
Committee?
Oh, just a comment. As we delve into this, I realize that we probably need and I'm completely in favor of these bills, we probably need a good on-site inspection. I think we should get on a riverboat in Ontario, spend about a week on the river really checking this out carefully before making a rash decision today. So license delayed 1 week and have an opportunity to have an on-site inspection.
I'm sure the television feed goes straight to the Government Ethics Commission, and I appreciate those comments. I don't think we all concur, Senator Bates.
Just for research.
Senator
Lewis, I'll go with you.
Doctor, I wonder if you could, you commented on some of the ramifications of invasive species when they go unchecked. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on how what danger is posed to the commercial fishing industry.
Well, certainly the commercial fishing industry is based, it's a biological system that we're dealing with, and many of those fish species are high on the sort of trophic pyramid. So I think I can't answer the question precisely, but I can tell you that it's probably a mistake to start messing around with systems when we really don't understand how they function very well. And these small changes in the base of the food web could have repercussions sort of upstream in the food web. Certain species, like, for example, the quagga mussel that's threatening the West now, is a filter feeder. It's freshwater filter feeder. But those kind of organisms can filter most of the food out of the water column and so basically reduce the productivity of the system. Other species like crabs can be predaceous on native crabs that are part of our fishing industry. So there are many potential impacts, and most of them are hard to predict at this point.
Good. All right. Thank you, Doctor. Ms. Allen. Representative Witt. And you have Deborah Marriott with you. Is that right?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Witt, state representative from House District 31, otherwise known as the River District, appearing today in support of Senate Bill 643 and 644. As you mentioned, Mr. Chairman, Deborah Marriott, who is the executive director of the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership, is here with me today as well. These bills are intended to set in motion efforts to avoid the introduction of aquatic non-indigenous species into our state's rivers, streams, estuaries, and lakes. My prepared statement describes two extremely menacing species, both the zebra mussel and mitten crab. In the interest of brevity, just a few facts, Mr. Chairman, about the former. The zebra mussel is prolific, producing up to 1 million eggs per year. It was first discovered in 1982 in the Great Lakes region, and within 10 years, these mussels had spread throughout the entire Mississippi, Tennessee, Hudson, and Ohio River basins. By 2003, they were found in the Missouri River, and as recently as January of this year, they were discovered in Lake Mead in Nevada. Mussel densities of over 1 million per square meter have been recorded in parts of Lake Erie. Mr. Chairman, a picture is truly worth a thousand words, and to share some of the extent of the menace that we face, again, I brought with me Deborah Marriott. As I said, executive director of the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership, bi-state effort aimed at restoring and enhancing habitat in the ecosystem in the estuary, essentially from Bonneville Dam down to the mouth of the river. Also to reduce pollution and toxic substances and to educate our public on the need for these kinds of enhancements. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn that over to Ms. Marriott.
Thank you, Representative Witt. Thank you very much, Chairman Avakian, and members of the committee for allowing us to speak with you this afternoon. We do work in the lower 146 miles of the Columbia River. We would like to take...
Oh, I need you to, just because we're recording, to just identify your name on the record.
Thank you. Deborah Marriott, Executive Director of the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership. I'm also here today with Scott McEwen, who is the Director of our Technical Programs. It's a pleasure to follow Dr. Sisma. He and his colleagues are taking the lead on this issue in the Lower River. I applaud the efforts that you and the state have put into this. I think why I'm excited to be here is it's a problem that we're facing, but it's a problem that we can actually do something about before hopefully it gets out of hand. There are a series of invasive species that we are looking at in the Lower Columbia River. There are actually hundreds of species that have invaded our part of the Northwest, but there are five that are known to be particularly of concern to us. The Chinese mitten crab, which has already been detected here, the zebra mussel, which Representative Witt has identified. Unfortunately, we have not yet seen them here. The New Zealand mud snail, the purple loosestrife, a plant that I'm sure you're familiar with, the Amur goby, and the Eurasian mulfar. The first, the Chinese mitten crab. This is what the fellow looks like. I understand he or she can be about the size of an Alaska king crab.
These swallows are significant because they do bury into the banks of the streams and the river. That destabilizes the dikes and the levees and can have significant impact on our flood protection as those banks are eroded. And as we noted, those have been detected in the lower river. The zebra mussel, as Representative Witt has indicated, is particularly invasive. It's in the picture on the right of the screen actually is a water pipe, picture taken out of the Great Lakes area. The water pipe is cut in half here for you to see the how extensive the zebra mussel has taken over that pipe. This, of course, has pretty significant impacts on our infrastructure. Critter also has significant impacts on our locks, dams, reservoirs, anything that is susceptible to it attaching itself. The New Zealand mud snail, which has also been sighted here recently, has significant impact because it's such an invasive, it is not only invasive, but it expands itself very quickly, virtually replaces all the other bottom feeding and dwelling species. This has particular concern, as most of these do, to the salmon and steelhead in our rivers because they're essentially taking over the food chain and the food that sustains those species. Purple loosestrife, when I looked at this picture, I thought, well, that's pretty. What's wrong with that? It's a particularly invasive plant. It takes over a lot of the habitat. It's very, very pervasive in the lower river, lower Columbia River. It essentially takes over the ecosystems, the habitat of a lot of our waterfowl, ducks and geese are compromised by its invasion. Our program has a pretty active volunteer program, and our volunteers have been out at some calculations they've removed over 83 truckloads of invasive species, but as you know, it has to be done in a particular way, so we're disposing of them properly. So it's one that we're actively working on, but it seems to be getting ahead of us. The Amur Gobi, which I'm a little less familiar with than some of the others, is also of concern here. It eats the eggs of salmon and trout, so that has a very obvious impact on their ability to survive and repopulate. And let's see, the Eurasian milfoil, also a new one to me, as we were putting together our information recently. This has particular concern to boating and fishing communities. It grows rapidly. As you can see in these photos, it's choking the motors of motorcraft. It's a very fast-growing and invasive plant that sort of takes over and creates dead zones where otherwise we would be enjoying recreational uses of waterways. And our last slide, and we have borrowed greatly from the research from Portland State and Dr. Sisma. Here we're trying to show the extent of the number of species that have presented themselves. Again, most of these are coming from ballast water. We think that that continued emphasis that you're placing and the bills before you place on this issue are instrumental and will be in making sure that we can get a handle on these species and prevent others from arriving here. I think what's significant about these species is if you can prevent them from showing up in your river system, you're way ahead of the game. Once they're here, it's very difficult because of the way they populate and how invasive they are to get a handle on them. But if we are proactive in this, we, I think, can get ahead of the curve on some of them. I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon.
Committee? Nothing. Well, thank you very much. Did you want to say something in closing, Representative?
Just say, Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity, and we look forward to receiving these bills in the other chamber.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with respect to both chambers, we've got two Senate bills over here that we're moving today. But I want folks to know that there is great thanks to Representative Witt for just being a tremendous leader on the issue on the other side of the building, having put in his own bills on that side, gathering support, bringing the scientists together, and I think without your efforts, we wouldn't have been this far with it. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you. Bob Danko and Rob Douglas.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'll be brief. We support SB 643 and appreciate the committee considering it and hoping the committee will pass that out. The bill's similar to the effort that has been there over the last 6 years, and we've done a very minimal job with no funding to implement that ballast water law. We cannot support 644 because it's not part of the governor's recommended budget. It has a fiscal impact of about $190,000 of general funds, and that includes a sample analysis. So I just want to say that for the record. One other thing, I was asked to put on the record that on SB 643, when our director appoints the task force, we will continue having a representative or more than one representative from the ports.
Mr. Danko, I understand that while protocol would have you not support 644, that if it were the legislature's choice to give you that funding, that additional FTE, that you would welcome providing the service to the state.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Douglas?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Douglas, representing the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association, the industry referred to in previous testimony. We are here in support. We support the work that Dr. Sitzma has been doing on this issue. We try and be responsive as industry to him. I would just like to highlight one thing that Mark said, and that is down the road we feel it's essential that there be a bi-state approach to this issue on the Columbia River. We don't think it makes sense to have different standards. Thank you.
Very good. Committee? Nothing? Well, thank you both then. Ken Armstrong, Annette Price, and Dave Moskowitz. Jason doesn't make it. I guess we're going to start with you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Price. I am the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and I'm here today in support of both bills 643 and 644. The Port of Portland has appreciated working with PSU on the task force, and certainly appreciate Dr. Sisma's advocacy and his knowledge. And for the funding bill, Senate Bill 644, we're also in support of providing DEQ. We believe that it is a modest request and support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group, of which the Port of Portland is a member, and Ms. Price, by the way, is the president of the Oregon Ports Group, and so I'm here to backstop her on that, let you know that all the ports are supportive of this important legislation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Moskowitz, why don't we go to you, and then we'll open it up for questions if need be.
Thank you, Chair Rocky and members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, representing the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, and speaking on behalf of Tom Wolf, the council president. And Trout Unlimited supports both these bills. We have written testimony we will submit after the hearing, and also there's some materials from Trout Magazine, which is a magazine that Trout Unlimited sends to its members across the nation, advising them how to not be unwitting introducers of exotic species. And so we just want to share that we have a long history of trying to educate anglers and boaters on this issue of introductions, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. I think you might have one from Senator Atkinson.
No, just the fly fishing community has been on this issue for a long, long 15 mm-hmm. years.
Kitty, anything?
Nope.
All right, well, thank you three very much. It's always a good sign when the committee has no questions of anybody. is there anybody else that would like to testify on either Senate Bill 643 or 644? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 643 and 644. I'm going to open up a work session on 643 and 644. And Senator Atkinson, if I could have a motion from you to move both bills to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass. Pass.
If you could, what? Is there an extra?
Mr. Chair, I would be delighted to take your cue and move Senate Bill 643 and 644 both to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any discussion? And are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and both bills will move. Thank you, everybody, for coming in and testifying. It's a very important bill. We appreciate you being here. Senator Bates is going to have to leave us. He is due in Ashland, but thank you for being here for those two. And with that, I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 373. Mike Graney, if you don't mind coming up, Sue Marshall will give us a brief introduction, but before she does that, I just want to let folks know this is the Oregon Renewable Energy Act that we've talked about. We're starting off today with what will be two and a half probably weeks of hearings on this important piece of legislation. I commented when we had the bottle bill the other day that we were embarking down a quite historic path with that bottle bill expansion, and we do so again with this bill. We will have several that are aimed at making some tremendous changes in the way that Oregon manages its natural resources and protects its environment. This is one of those. Mr. Graney, we're glad you're here, and Ms. Marshall, if you don't mind.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 373 requires the State Department of Energy to create a renewable portfolio standard under which electric utilities must derive 20% of annual retail electricity sales from renewable energy resources by the year 2025. It authorizes the department to adopt rules to implement the standard.
I should mention, too, before you begin, what we're going to do today is Mr. Graney is just going to give us an overview of, the terminology, the concepts and theories and of this type of renewable energy effort, and then he'll go through what we have as a draft of the bill that we'll have in final version soon for the benefit of the committee. He'll be the only person testifying today, but starting next week we'll have some invited testimony and then a lot of time for public testimony before we move to a work session. I did want the committee, though, to have a copy, if we have them, Matt, if we have them in the room, a copy of the draft legislation, because I think Mr. Green will be referring to it. With that?
Yeah, another handout, too.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Mike Graney, the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'd like to first perhaps give a broad overview of the issue and why we would, are supporting and asking the committee to pass a renewable energy standard or renewable portfolio standard, as it's sometimes referred to. And what I'm passing out is it's a summary of our five bills. I think most of you in the audience also have seen that before, but on the back page there's a list of issues regarding the renewable portfolio standard legislation that I'll be coming back to as part of the discussion today. As I go along, please feel free to, with Chairman's permission, to interrupt and ask questions if you'd like. The first question is, why do we are we asking for legislation like this? This standard is part of a package of incentives and other measures to substantially increase our use of renewable energy in Oregon. Look at power plants, but also vehicles. There's a biofuels package focusing on the fuels for our vehicles. The power plants are certainly a very important part. And the package is a combination of incentives and a standard. We think this is important because we're at a critical time in Oregon's energy future. For many power plants throughout the 1990s were built primarily to use natural gas. Natural gas is a very clean burning fuel. It was at the time promoted as a bridge fuel to the future. That future, I think, has arrived because the price of natural gas has become increasingly expensive to use for power plants. New power plants under consideration, for the most part, are not using natural gas. In Oregon, they can't use nuclear because nuclear is illegal because of under Oregon law, until a permanent waste repository is operating and in turn approved by the voters to go ahead with nuclear power. So there's basically two options. There's renewable energy, which we've seen some significant developments in the last few years, and there's coal. And coal that meets federal and state air quality standards presents many significant issues on air quality for traditional pollutants, mercury and global warming issues. So I think the question before you is the importance of a measure like this to help make the choice that our utilities make and independent power producers make for our future load growth from renewable energy rather than from more coal. So that's one of the reasons for the bill. Another important benefit is that having a renewable energy standard would assure the renewable energy industry that there's a market for power from renewable energy. That will help assure investors to invest in these projects in Oregon. About half the states in the United States have a renewable energy standard of some type, and they vary all over the board in terms of what their targets are, what utilities are covered, what measures qualify for renewable energy. But the standard we are proposing would make Oregon one of the leaders, if not the leader, in terms of the percentage and end goal of renewable energy. With the proposal is, if you look again on this back page of the chart, the first point there, the renewable or the RPS requirement there of 25% by 2025 applies to new renewable energy, and that would be, depending on Oregon's rate of load growth, cover most, if not all, of our new energy generation would come from renewable energy with this standard. So it's a very aggressive standard, but it's also a standard we think that's very workable. This proposal has been under review for over a year, which surfaced it. Governor Kongoski established a renewable energy working group chaired by Mike MacArthur, and I'm not sure if Mike's here today. Mike did extraordinary work bringing the group together and leading the group through a series of issues. This is a very complicated bill, and as you look at the draft that you have before you today from Legislative Council, it is very complicated. There are a lot of issues. We reached consensus on some issues. We didn't on others. We certainly at least narrowed the scope of the issues that I hope that you'll have before you. We had about 30 people who were members of that working group, many of whom are in this room or who are were represented by people who are in this room. We had both public and private utilities, industry, we had environmental groups, we had representatives of the different renewable energy technologies as all participants of this group, trying to work through the different issues that are involved in making a renewable energy standard a workable standard and a fair standard. So one of the issues then was what are the targets? We mentioned 25% by the year 2025, but also that the bill would have interim targets, so it would be great progress to make sure that we're on track. So it calls for 5% by the year 2011, 15% by the year 2015, and 20% by the year 2020. And again, that keeps you on this increasing track to hit the 25%, which is most if not all of our load growth in the coming decades. There was concern about how we treat smaller utilities, especially those who rely primarily on the Bonneville Power Administration, which are primarily consumer-owned utilities. What we proposed is that the 25% by 2025 standard applies to any utility that covers, that its volume of sales covers 1% or more of Oregon's load. And that covers about 10 utilities. And I have a chart here.
Yeah, while you do that, Mr. Graney, I want to just let the committee know that if you have questions, as Mr. Graney is going through, let's ask questions as he's presenting rather than waiting to the end, since there's a lot of information here.
And I'll be bouncing around on different issues, so please feel free to do so.
Senator Atkinson.
Oh, I wasn't over. I have two to what you've covered so far.
Okay.
Unless, I guess we'll go in reverse order. The one that, of what you just handed out, and there's been a lot of discussion before this actually popped out about some smaller utilities not obviously, being in and some being out. And that's the same for some PUDs are in and some PUDs are out?
That's correct. The list that you have, if you take the 1%, and this is our recommendation, ours being the departments, that was supported by many but not all the people in the Renewable Working Group. 1% gets you like 12 utilities. The two largest investor-owned utilities. It also gets picks up some PUDs, cooperatives, and municipals, and also Idaho Power, which is the other investor-owned electric utility in Oregon, but much smaller in Oregon than PGE and Pacific. Below that, let me stop there first and ask if.
So I'm looking. I've always been particularly interested, just as a size, in knowing quite a bit about Oregon Trail Electric. So under what you've just said, Oregon Trail Electric at 1.43% would qualify.
Yes, would be covered as we initially proposed, and as I believe the bill as drafted currently provides, they would be covered. Everybody that's over 1%. Now, one of the things that the bill draft does that's different from the outline you have, we had proposed a lesser standard, but nevertheless a standard for smaller utilities regarding a percentage of their load growth. I believe the bill draft that you have in front of you now would exempt those utilities entirely that are under 1%.
That are under 1%?
Yes.
So it would still include people like Oregon Trail?
Yes. And, of course, I mean, the committee has the option of deciding what's an appropriate threshold. But this gives you the information of where you draw the line, what the implications would be in terms of moving that line up or down.
Okay. May I ask my other question? He already covered it, but before he gets too far.
Feel free to
At the beginning of your remarks, you were talking about the problem with nuclear, the problem with coal, and then Senator Lebyer and I ran the new energy siting law in 01, I think, though. Is that right? Do you remember that?
I do. I think it was either 99 or 01. I think it was 01. I've been here too long.
Yes. You became PUD guy. Anyway. What do other states that have this standard have inside their portfolio?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, the portfolio is focused on renewable energy. Sometimes there's differences on when the renewable energy had to be developed. There may be differences as to which forms are in, for example, whether hydro counts or doesn't count, whether municipal solid waste counts or doesn't count. But the renewable portfolio standards are limited to renewable energy. To my knowledge, none of them include nuclear or any of the fossil fuels.
But what you're saying, and just by way of what we do in Oregon, we are limiting ourselves already without this bill. We are significantly limited in what we can call renewable. We won't use nuclear. We won't use coal. We'll try to use wind, right? And then there's a political debate whether or not we should use existing hydro or back to a predated hydro standard. So what else could be part of the standard if it's not wind and it's not water?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, our standard, as we proposed, it would include new hydro. It would also include efficiency improvements on existing hydro. In addition to wind, biomass, geothermal, solar, there are a number of renewable resource technologies listed in the definitions in the bill. So we've tended to be inclusive. Fossil fuel and nuclear fuel are excluded, and those are.
Excuse me. What was the third? It says biomass, geothermal, and
solar.
Solar. It's long. At the end of the day, my solar.
And biomass can't. Includes forest and farm waste. It also can include wastewater treatment plants, municipal solid.
So one more, for instance, and then I'll let you continue real quick. So we've got a bill floating around here that will allow OIT with some capital improvement grants to develop geothermal on their campus, which will make it a 100% green campus.
Yes.
So in so doing, if there's excess geothermal, and I'll probably say this at an amateur level rather than at your professional level, but if there's excess energy generated from the geothermal and it gets on the PacifiCorp grid, can PacifiCorp use that then as part of their mandate minimum?
Yes, Senator. Yes.
Thank you.
The questions, right? Before I move on.
Mr. Chair. Senator Beyer. Thank you. A couple questions. I didn't think you've gotten down to this far into the bill. It starts out in the whereas clause. It says, the second whereas, I guess, is that Oregon's electric utilities need to decrease their reliance on fossil fuels for energy generation. Can you give me the percentage today of what our utilities use fossil fuels?
As Chairman, Senator Beyer, currently the state has served 40% by hydro, 40% by coal. Most of that coal is from the mountain states, although we have one coal plant in Oregon, eastern Oregon, and we have one in western Washington, some of which Oregon utilities purchase. Then the remainder is about 10% is natural gas, and the remainder is other renewable energy, just another 10% or so.
Then one more, Mr. Chair. When you were mentioning what is renewable, I think the way I've read this is that municipal solid waste would not be renewable, so that would mean that the garbage burning plant that creates energy out in Brooks would not be counted as renewable?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, that's correct for purposes of meeting the standard, and there's two reasons. One is the date that plant became operational. Resources under the bill as currently written would go back to 1995, and that plant predates that by more than a decade. But also, as currently written, and again, this is a policy choice for the committee, methane from municipal solid waste would count, but burning the garbage would not.
So no matter when the plant is built, whether
as it's currently drafted, that's correct.
That's what I thought.
I think as a practical matter, we're not likely to see new garbage burners because of the volume of feedstock that's needed to make those viable. We had no information indicating that there was any interest in doing so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me mention, so there's first the issue of smaller utilities and how they're treated, and for purposes of the bill introduction, we start at 1%. There are some other issues related to smaller utilities, although to a lesser extent it applies to larger utilities as well, and that is for one that our smaller utilities, of course, rely very heavily on low-cost Bonneville Power Administration hydropower, but even our larger utilities have access to not only their own hydropower, but the Mid-Columbia dams in the state of Washington, they have long-term contracts for some of that power. The purpose of this renewable energy standard is not to focus on decisions in the past in terms of, say, forcing any utility to shut down existing power plants or to give up access to low-cost hydro. It's focusing on load growth. So under the bill, no utility would be required to give up any of those resources or access to those resources in order to meet the standard. The standard would not be met otherwise, then, as it's written, the standard would not be met under those circumstances. Would not have to be. Any questions on that? We also think that it's that as renewable energy is becoming less expensive, it's not likely to be more expensive than relying on traditional resources, especially as natural gas continues to increase in price, and as we see coal subject to increased regulation both for mercury emissions and likely for carbon dioxide emissions as well. We think coal is going to be facing additional economic penalties, so that in fact the renewable energy standard is not likely to cause an increase in rates beyond that they would have otherwise been. However, the bill does provide for what we call a cost cap, so that in the event costs would go up higher because of compliance with the standard, and that cap is one of the things we've spent a lot of time negotiating, how it's formulated and what the figure is, and I think there's still not complete agreement on it, but the ballpark figure that people have been using is 4%. So if rates go up 4% higher than they would have otherwise without the bill, then the RPS, then the standard does not have to be met. So that cost cap sets a limit on the rate impacts that could occur under the bill. And that cost cap would be calculated periodically over the life of the standard. There are also provisions in the bill about compliance. And in general, for investor-owned utilities, for most provisions in terms of meeting the bill, the Public Utility Commission would be in charge of assuring compliance and setting standards and procedures for assuring compliance with the renewable energy standard. For the consumer-owned utilities, their governing boards would be responsible. Who would be responsible for preparing an evaluation based on information they provide, but the consumer-owned utilities would continue to have their own oversight. This does not impose a regulatory oversight by either the Public Utility Commission or the Department of Energy over consumer-owned utilities. So again, that was in response to concerns they had about a renewable energy standard. As part of that, also there's a mechanism for utilities to comply with the standard in the event they're not able to acquire sufficient renewable energy to meet the target. It's called an alternate compliance standard or an alternate payment standard, where they would pay money into a fund that would be dedicated to renewable energy. And in the case of the consumer-owned utilities, they would manage that fund themselves individually, but the fund would have to be devoted to purchase of renewable energy in the future to help meet those targets.
Senator Atkinson.
You mentioned what you just said, and you also mentioned coal earlier, that we have, what was it, 40%?
Yes.
In oil? But the coal is generated, that energy is generated where?
Most of the coal, Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, is from power plants in Wyoming and Montana. There's the Boardman coal plants, about 500 megawatts, and the Centralia, Washington coal plant, which our utilities receive some power.
So, also. But thank you. So most of it, I mean, I actually thought there was some in Utah, too, but I'm wrong.
There is. I don't believe any of that's currently serving Oregon loads, but I'm not entirely sure.
So if an investment is made, let's say, in Northern California for wind power,
mm-hmm.
a big wind farm goes in there, and it's easier to put it in there because of either it's more windy, it makes more economic sense, or it's a transmission line issue. But that utility that is pumping that wind clean energy into Oregon, can they use that as part of their minimum?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, they can. That gets into one of the more complicated sections of the bill regarding renewable energy certificates, but there's a mechanism set up to track basically the renewable energy that's generated both in-state and out-of-state.
But that standard, the compliance of that and managing that, what probably ends up to be an extremely complicated mathematical equation, is done by the PUC?
Yes, for investor-owned utilities, Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, that's correct. Although the western states have developed a Westride system of tracking what's called renewable energy credits and renewable energy certificates, so that this can be done in a practical way and in a sort of a uniform way across the western states.
Can credits be traded?
To some extent, yes, Mr. Chairman. I think it's time. I'm going to call my technical expert. I think I've getting definitely into more details. Bill Drumheller has been working on this issue a lot. Defer to Bill.
Bill, after you put your name on the record, Bill, you ought to tell the committee a little bit about what you've been doing over the last year with regard to this, so
okay.
We know something about your background. Okay. And I think the senator has more questions for you.
For the record, my name is Bill Drumheller. I'm with the Oregon Department of Energy. I've also been serving essentially lead staff on the RPS at ODO, and I was also, up until recently, lead staff to the Renewable Energy Working Group that Michael MacArthur chairs.
Well, the question just came up about these credits being able to be traded on the open market.
Yes, that's actually the prime purpose of this system, would be to create a common currency. These renewable energy certificates, or RECs, as they're known in the industry. And this system that Mike here just talked about would establish a common currency for all the western states. If you're familiar with the Western Governors Association region,
I tried to do it.
Yeah, that region.
My question is this. I mean, I guess this would be more rather than a technical question, but more of a political one, because in the late 60s, early 70s, all the way up to the early 80s, we had pollution tax credits, and there was all these business cases I remember from business school on scrubber and scrubber technology of coal-fired power plants and all that. And those pollution credits, which were set up on the same similar market that were tradable, but the environmental community over time was against the market function of those tradable pollution credits. Do I have my history vaguely correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
So we are now at a major paradigm shift where we're trying to introduce this market force back into renewable energy. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, it is, and it's also being looked at for carbon dioxide regulation. One of the options that's being considered, and it's a different issue, is a cap and trade system also.
Well, the question then for the committee to consider is, are we making a false incentive that at some point the legislature is going to want to take away?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, the renewable energy credits are intended to be one tool that utilities can use, so they can develop their own power in state. They could buy power from another developer, and if that Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, the renewable energy credits are intended to be one tool that utilities can use, so they can develop their own power in state. They could buy power from another developer, and if that power is out of state, like your example is, this provides a way of tracking that, both the power and the credits, so that they're not double counted or resold twice. That's really the primary purpose.
Okay. It's an interesting policy dynamic. Thank you.
We'll mention a couple more points sort of on the broad level, and then we can perhaps go into more detail if you'd like on the bill itself as it's been currently drafted. The bill would extend the public purpose charge through the duration of the renewable energy standard, so that would be through 2025, and that's 3% charge that's imposed on investor-owned utilities. Most of that funding goes to the Energy Trust, and most of that, again, goes for energy efficiency. About 20%, 15-20% of the funding goes for renewable energy. The bill would extend that public purpose charge at that time, and the portion that goes to renewable energy would be devoted to smaller resources, non-utility scale resources, where financing issues appear to be greater. And related to that, there's also a goal, but not a target, of one-third of the renewable energy standard should be small-scale, what's called community-based systems, again, which are smaller than 20 megawatts. That's in some states there are hard carve-outs that X% of the target must be no more than X percent from wind, a certain percentage from biomass, a certain percentage from solar, geothermal, etc. Our group spent a lot of time talking about that. There was concern about having hard targets for each class of renewable, but also support for doing something to encourage the diversity of renewable energy resources. And, for example, solar, geothermal, some of the biomass projects tend to be much smaller in scale than the new large wind energy projects that are going forward. And that's the reason for that provision in the bill. Maybe I can stop there and see if there's any questions so far.
Why don't you keep plowing ahead?
Okay. Why don't we turn to the actual language of the bill draft then, and feel free to jump in as we go along. We turn to the definitions.
Just so you can manage your time too, I'm planning on stopping the committee at about 25 after.
Okay. Okay. We talked about some of the definitions already in terms of renewable energy, but bank renewable energy certificates, again, gets into the question that Senator Atkinson raised previously about trading credits. And qualifying electricity, and I think that's really the key issue in terms of what qualifies in Section 3. First, the resource has to be located in the United States, and there was concern that Canadian facilities, especially new hydro facilities that might be developed in Canada, would qualify to meet the renewable energy standard. They would not be eligible under this legislation. The hydroelectricity generated after January 1st, 1995, or efficiency upgrades for any facility, regardless of age, would qualify, as well as the other renewable energy sources listed in Sections 4, which was including wind, solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, wave, tidal, ocean energy, geothermal energy, and then electricity from various biomass resources. And as we discussed before, biogas, for example, from municipal solid waste, from methane recovery, would qualify. Municipal solid waste from burning garbage would not. Wood waste would qualify. And again, the date, initially the working group had settled on 1998, which is when the new sort of generation of large wind resources came in. There was strong support, though, for picking up a number of biomass resources that had come in just within a year or two before that. So we went back to 1995. There's nothing magic about that date, but that was the logic for picking those dates. Section 5 has, and Section 6 have the renewable portfolio standard itself that we've discussed previously, the different targets leading up to 25% by the year 2025. There's details on how you calculate that standard in each of the given years. There are Section 7 covers some of the exemptions from compliance, and we've talked about some of those already, including the not having to give up Fargo power or the Columbia Dam power. And then Section 8 regarding small utilities, as is currently written, any utility under 1% of the load of the state, that goes back to your list, would be exempt under the standard, but not have any obligation. There is a provision, there are two provisions that of note there. One is that there's actually a sunset near 2020 in that exemption, and that was suggested to give the legislature an opportunity to reevaluate that exemption for smaller utilities, whether that should in fact be reinstated. So the way this is written, it rather than saying the sunset expires or the exemption expires in 2020, it affirmatively imposes the obligation in 2020 and starts with 5% that year, which is the standard for the first target year is 5%. That's the reason for that there. That's the way the legislative council wrote it. There's also a requirement that the exemption could be forfeited if the exempt utilities meet their load growth from new coal plants. So again, as long as they're not developing coal, they would be exempt under this provision. Any questions so far?
Mike, could you say that one more time?
Yes.
On the coal part.
The concern there is that if the utility is exempt from the renewable energy standard because of the size and because of the various burdens of reporting and acquisitions, we don't want the, those utilities to turn around, whether it's individually or as a group, to purchase ownership in new coal plants.
Okay.
And there are some new coal plants being proposed in both Oregon and Washington, north of Portland, on either side of the river, one by Energy Northwest, which are the people that developed the Whoops plants, and they would be looking for public power throughout the Northwest to purchase, either purchase the power or purchase ownership shares. There's also an independent private developer at the westward site near Klatskanai that has a site certificate from our siting council for a natural gas plant but wants to change it to a coal plant just because of the market, and would be selling that on the open market as well. So there, that is the reason for our wish to have a provision that precludes that option.
One other question on that, if I could, and that's basically, since you're taking that precaution, is there any reason or any way that you could keep someone from entering into a contract at this point on specs to that plant opening up and having something already obligating?
Mr. Chairman, so I was asking, if I understand your question correctly, once the if this law were to take effect as written, then if a utility did so, I think they would jeopardize their standing as an exempt utility.
Okay.
Yeah, they could enter into the contract, but then they would be subject to the renewable standard.
Okay.
Section 9, the renewable energy standard, also applies to electricity service suppliers, and these are independent providers of electricity, neither public nor private utilities, who are directly serving some of the large industrial customers. And we have a number of them in the state. I'm not sure how many offhand. But this the standard would apply to them as well, and they would be subject to PUC oversight, as they currently are, just for their general delivery of power. And this was one of the developments that occurred with deregulation, that we have non-utility providers of utility service to some large industrial customers. Any questions there so far? Section 10, we mentioned the alternative compliance payment previously as an alternative for utilities if they are not able to meet the targets through direct acquisition or direct purchase of renewable energy, and there's reporting requirements there. And then the cost limitation, that's what we call the cost cap, and that's section 12, and it is a fairly lengthy and complicated section that is, I'm sure, a work in progress, but it would basically be a calculation, as I mentioned before, of what the rates are caused by the renewable energy standard versus what they would have been otherwise. And if it goes 4% above what they would have been otherwise, then the cost cap comes into play.
So that is the consumer's mandate cost protection section? Would that be fair to say?
It's intended to provide protection to consumers, Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, that's correct.
4%.
Yes, it would allow up to 4%. And part of that is there may be, especially initially, increased costs. There also may be, there's a margin of error in calculating these rates. If there's a substantial rate increase, that's not anything we're interested in. If it's within a few percent, that while we say this is higher than the rates would have been anyway, we could well be wrong.
So how long does that stay in effect?
That would stay in effect for the life of the standard. And at any point in time, if the 4% cap were breached, then the standard, the targets would be inapplicable at that point. If rates came down in terms of compliance, then the standard would come into play again and would have to be adjusted based on the fact that
there were years where the standard was not in place.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, maybe if I could make clear. So it's basically an annual determination. So I mean, the compliance with the standard is an annual determination. Part of that determination process would be this cost cap process.
So it's another simple question, but important to signpost. And this is regulated by the PUC.
Yes, for investor-owned utilities and the electricity service providers.
So let me take you to a hypothetical then. In my mind, at least, let's assume that. I mean, we've got, as I look at the market right now, we've got really the frontier. I mean, we've got a very volatile market. We've got speculators. I mean, it's really the Wild West out there. And over the next 5 to 7 years, the market, like in most markets, will consolidate, and that'll happen. But in so doing, we are hoping, by the leadership of government creating a mandate, which you might not ever hear me formulate that sentence again, but what we're hoping is that new technologies would be created. But we also assume the risk that some technologies might be a disaster, might not work. What kind of consumer protections are there if a large utility or a small utility gets tangled up in a technology or in a project that doesn't produce, and now we're looking at retiring 20, 30 years worth of investment on the backs of consumers? What kind of protection is based in for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, if I understand your question, for the investor-owned utilities, their major investments still are subject to prudency review by the Public Utility Commission. And in fact, just recently, the Commission made a determination, denied a request by PacifiCorp to invest in two new large coal plants to serve Oregon because of the options that were available in renewable energy and cost-effective energy conservation, so that with the wind farms that are available with other resources, the Commission determined that would not be a prudent investment. But that type of review will be ongoing throughout the life of the standard.
Let's just take it, again, one more step, not to belabor it, but we are hoping we will be the state that pioneers wave technology. And in wave technology, you've got two or three different competing models of how that best works. I mean, you've got it on top, you've got it inside, you've got all these various models. And over time, over the next 15, 20 years, we're going to see what works the best. But until that time, we might hypothetically have three different wave, ocean motion type of things happening out there that produce. One's going to flop. Someone's going to have to eat the cost of that investment. And you're saying that at least unless we signpost it some other way or write it into the policy, that the PUC will safeguard the consumer over that investment and the peer or the efficiency review will do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, I believe so. Because the costs are going to be taken into account. Wave energy is not cost effective currently. It's substantially more expensive. Wind energy, especially with the federal production tax credits and with the benefits of state tax credits with legislation that's been now is cost competitive, certainly with natural gas and in some cases with coal. Some of the other resources, biomass, can be, depending on the circumstances.
But very, very little of this is cost competitive, and that's one of the policy implications of the government getting involved is if we're saying that this is a value and this is something we want to move to, we're actually, wouldn't you agree that the government here is making a market with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, certainly assisting the market, but I think it's in doing so, it's helping to make the costs of renewable energy more competitive.
Over time. But not immediately.
But in some cases, with the federal production tax incentive, wind energy is cost competitive with fossil energy.
Thank you.
Let's see. And then the next few sections in the bill go into the renewable energy certificates. That deals with the trading mechanism that we talked about previously for a purchase of renewable energy. And again, those certificates give the utilities an additional option, although there are renewable energy certificates even with power that you own. Right, if you develop your own power plant that are tracked, but you can get those through developing your own power facility, purchasing power,
and in some cases, a limited number of cases, purchasing what we call unbundled renewable certificates, and might have Bill, you want to explain unbundled certificates?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what, and I believe the terminology in this, in the language that LC drafted is the purchase renewable energy certificate, but a fundamental concept of the trading concepts Senator Atkinson referenced earlier is the ability to trade these across the market, and these certificates would be generated, would be issued when this renewable energy is generated. In other words, a windmill spits out some power, and at least conceptually, a certificate, a tracking mechanism would simultaneously be created in a computer somewhere, that, and that system actually is coming into existence right now. But one of the advantages, that certificate can, at least conceptually, travel along with that power, if you will, to the point where it's delivered, or it can be separated. That's the concept of unbundling, taking a certificate and having that go one direction, the power perhaps another. And so you would have the option of just buying these certificates, but these certificates would represent the generation of 1 megawatt hour of renewable energy.
I think we're going to wrap it up pretty quick for the day. We'll have more time, obviously, in the next 2 weeks to talk more, but I'd like to hit on just one other topic before we end, and that is if you could explain IRP and how that has been used in the past and how that relates to the reporting requirements under this act.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, IRP is the Integrated Resource Plans, and that's a process that the Public Utility Commission has for reviewing investor-owned utility resource acquisitions and other major expenses of utilities. The IRPs, it is a separate process, but to the extent that it reflects the decisions of the commission on prudence and acquisitions would certainly be, would affect the acquisition of resources that could meet the standard. And in fact, the commission's decision on the two coal plants that I mentioned previously was in the context of an IRP planning process.
There may be some concern from folks in the industry that this is a layering on of an additional reporting system that maybe duplicates the IRP or conflicts with it in some ways. Could you give some comment on that before we finish?
Mr. Chairman, to the extent that either the commission or we, for our reporting responsibilities in this act, can use existing processes and reports, will certainly do so. We've been, for example, there's a section directing us to do a study on the jobs impacts of this bill. I've seen a couple of other energy bills as well. We would be looking at the entire package of incentives as well as standards if all these bills pass, and probably not do separate studies on each one, but try to assess in one study that the impact, the incremental impact of each of the different measures. And I'm sure the commission would look for ways to consolidate its efforts, its own efforts, and then the reporting that it imposes on utilities to get the data it needs as well.
With that, committee, I think we'll finish for the day. Mr. Drumhill and Mr. Graney, thank you very much. We'll pick it up again next week. And with that, we will close the public hearing, Senate Bill 373, and we will adjourn for the day. Thank you.